Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womax and Friends. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, musicians, and comedians that perform here and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what makes our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Don Davis Womack.
Hello, laughers. Today we wrap up our series this year on health and fitness with a remarkable guest, the one and only Dr. Stephanie Curdy Luden. She is a kinesiology professor, graduate director of the exercise physiology program here at James Madison University, and an outdoor enthusiast. Her research explores how lifestyle factors like exercise and nutrition impact chronic diseases. Stick around for her story, her insights, and her top five health and fitness tips that will help you elevate your well-being. Welcome to the show, Stephanie. It's great to have you on today.
Thanks, Dawn. Great to be here.
Yes, we have known each other for how long? How long have you been at JMU now?
This is my eighth year, which blows my mind how fast that's gone.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I know. You were one of the first people I hung out with here in Harrisonburg.
Oh!
I know, and it made me love it immediately.
That's so special. It's true. Love you, yeah. Too. And we call her Steph for short.
So yes, call me Steph, please.
I'm gonna do that throughout the interview. So you get to know her too, like a friend.
That's right. Yep. Contact me just like a friend.
That's right.
Yes.
This is so exciting to me because I have just admired and respected you from afar and the work that you do. And my husband, you know, is a JMU professor in kinesiology as well. And he has nothing but great things to say about your work and what you do.
Oh, thanks. Well, I think the same of you guys and what you're doing in this community. I mean, Chris is loved at JMU by students and faculty, and you obviously are just building this amazing community. So I feel honored to be here. I really do.
Oh, that's so exciting. I don't know much about your whole story, about what ignited your passion to get into all of this. So that's where I wanted to start, is just help us understand how you ended up here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thinking back, let's see. So, I was going to make a joke and start off with where I was born and then really go into depth. But I think I'll start off with around like college age.
Okay, let's
so
go.
I kid, or high school age. So I was a tennis player and athlete through high school. I had done a bunch of sports, but really had focused on tennis once I got into college. Mm. So I went to the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I played tennis there. And while I was there, I started off as a biology major, and I thought I wanted to go pre-med. Mm. And ultimately, I was taking these biology classes and chemistry, and I was doing some shadowing in the hospital, and I just knew I didn't want to do that. Mm. So I kind of proceeded through the coursework, really just, unfortunately, like a lot of students, just trying to get A's and not really thinking anything about what I really wanted to do. And it was when I took human physiology with a professor named Diane Baker. She was absolutely incredible and just really ignited my love for physiology. Fortunately, it was the first year she was offering an elective in exercise physiology. So I took that elective, and it was the first time really fire was lit, I think, where I was loving learning and I wasn't thinking about the grade. Mm. And that, after that, that's my loved it.
Wow.
So then I knew I wanted to do something with exercise physiology, but I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I was planning on taking a gap year, and I kind of like to normalize the search, you know, because we can stay curious and figure out what we want to do our whole lives.
Yeah.
You are still curious, clearly, as we were talking before. I think it's amazing.
Well, thank you.
So I knew I wanted to do something with exercise physiology. I didn't know what, so I wanted to take a gap year. But I just, at the time, didn't have any money, and I wasn't sure I wanted to live back at home. So I really, how I chose exercise physiology programs was applying by what had the latest deadline. And I ended up getting accepted into Florida Atlantic University.
Yeah.
And I think it's always, you know, it's also setting ourselves up well for the next position or the next thing we're going to do, even if we're not sure what it is. Mm-hmm. We just want to do the best we can to set ourselves up for it. Mm-hmm. So I ended up getting an offer for a teaching assistantship, which I think was one of the best things that happened to me because I was able to teach at Florida Atlantic University, which funded my tuition. So you get tuition remission.
Yeah, the graduate assistantship. Yeah,
exactly. So you're not paying for school and you're getting a small stipend, but then I got to explore teaching and that really was, now I got to figure out how to continue doing this passion of teaching and I followed that. So I loved exercise physiology so much at the master's level and I also loved teaching so much. So I thought, okay, maybe at this point I am okay being a teacher. Mm-hmm. So I actually had tried just teaching in a high school for a year. I taught advanced placement chemistry.
Really?
Yeah, I taught advanced placement chemistry in high school.
Did you like it?
I found some value in it. Mm-hmm. It just didn't like resonate with me to teach at that level. Mm-hmm. And I realized that pretty quickly after the first year. You know, I didn't have a background either in classroom management. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just about like really being excited. I thought teaching alone was enough, but the passion for the topic matters so much. Mm. Chemistry is fine, but it's not where my heart lies in physiology. Mm. So I knew then after that 1 year that I was going to try to get back into college teaching. You can do that as an instructor. Mm-hmm. And actually, you did that here for years, right, mm-hmm. as an adjunct. So I applied for all faculty positions or instructor positions at universities, and I got a call, a job offer after interviewing at Kansas State University. Mm. It was just a phone interview, so I hadn't even been there. I hadn't even been to Kansas.
Never.
Never. So I didn't mention I was born in Chicago. So it was like Chicago, and then end up, you know, undergrad in Virginia, grad school in Florida, and then
Kansas.
Yeah, and then okay, I'm gonna try Kansas. So I can remember driving into Kansas and my parents ended up driving me there. And my mom actually was tearing up a little, like when we were driving 2 hours with nothing around. And she said, I just don't know if you're, you know, going to be okay here or be happy here. And it's, you know me, I'm going to be able to make this the best decision that I've, mm-hmm. that I've made. And if it ends up at any point feeling like it's not, I'll transition elsewhere. And it was the best decision. I taught actually anatomy and physiology for a year there. I ran practicums and internships.
Wow.
And it was so cool. And it was the first time I really got to see this really vibrant research culture. So I knew at that point I wanted to be back in it. And fortunately, I also met someone who's named Craig Harms. He ended up being my doctoral advisor. But once I got to know him, even more than his research, him and I just knew it worked so well together. So I said, you know I want to work on a PhD in your laboratory. And he took me on as a student. And then I ended up getting a PhD in a cardiorespiratory exercise physiology lab.
That's great.
Yeah, so cool. And then at the culmination of that, I was at this another crossroads where I was writing a grant called the T32. It helps to fund another position before you go into a faculty position for a postdoc.
Okay, I did not know that.
Yeah, so right. I was writing it with a faculty at Anschutz Medical Center, and I was pretty sure I was going to be going and doing a postdoc there. Mm-hmm. And my advisor thought it would be really good to get interview experience. So I had applied several places, but I was pretty sure I was going to do the postdoc. And then once I interviewed at JMU, you just get these gut feelings. Like, mm-hmm. this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
So I remember when I got the offer at JMU and I talked to my advisor about it, he's so good at fostering, you know, this sense of independence, but he mm-hmm. does also give really good direct advice. And he thought the postdoc would be the way to go because I could then come to a place like JMU and it might be harder to go to JMU than go back and choose something different. Mm-hmm. And it just was a time I just completely knew in myself I needed to be at JMU. And
that's great.
I am in my eighth year here.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's long. That's long.
That's amazing. Now, and there are laughers that listen to this podcast around the world. And of course, not everybody is in academia. So I know that people that are in academia understand completely what a postdoctoral fellowship is and what that's about. Can you just give us a little, for somebody who doesn't even know what that means, can you just give us some context about what a postdoctoral fellowship is, how long does it go, and a little bit more elaborate about the benefits of doing one.
Yeah. Well, so I didn't do a postdoc. You don't have to.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you end up wanting to go, JMU is a research R2 institution. Mm-hmm. Based on how much research dollars we bring in, if you want to go to an R1 where you're bringing in a lot of research funding, a postdoc, I think in most fields, at least in sciences and physiology, is advised.
Okay.
Because you're really getting these extra years after you do a PhD to get, it's a pathway to independence. So you're focusing on your, you know, your writing, you're focusing on your research, and it's still under the advisement of a PI, which is a principal investigator. However, it's not where you're, it's this interim between a PhD and a full faculty load. So you're not going to be having the same teaching responsibilities that you would if you're in a faculty position. So it's a time when you can really develop your skills, learn a new skill, get a lot of writing done, try to get grant funding, and then apply to faculty positions. And in some places, you know, in some fields, even in physiology now, people do one postdoc or two postdocs.
They'll do two?
Yes.
I don't think I've heard of that before.
Yes, I've seen it.
Okay.
I mean, it can be where you choose one and then you want to learn extra skill sets or do extra clinical work, so you do another one.
I see.
And they can be anywhere from 2 years to more. You know, I'm not sure. I don't know the longest postdoc out there.
Oh, I've heard them. If someone does, put it in the comments.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe
be like,
it's you. You can let us know.
Yeah. Someone like, this is my 20th year in my postdoc. But yes, it's meant to be eventually you would transition into, you know, faculty role or another position.
Yeah. Research One Institution. I believe Michigan State's one of those, right?
It is.
As an example.
And even here, UVA is. We collaborate a lot with them. I love JMU, the responsibilities here. We still have a lot of opportunity to apply for funding, but we don't have to to keep our jobs. You know,
yeah,
we don't
have
to do that. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I'm glad I don't have to do that to keep mine.
Like, think of the pressure.
I'm serious.
To say,
kudos to all of you that are doing that work.
It is. To have to say, if you don't get a $1 million grant in the next 5 years, you actually are not going to get security in your job. I think it's, and then you know those funding rates are 5%.
Mm.
That's a tough pill to swallow.
It is. And yet some people, based on how they're built, thrive in those environments.
That's right.
So you got to know you.
You have to know you. That's exactly right. And I think a lot of people who end up doing postdocs, they either realize, or even PhDs, it helps you realize where you want to be. Do you want to do that, or do you want
something
else?
Yeah, it could be built for that specifically, and then you should do it.
That's right, exactly. It takes all kinds, and there's a place for all kinds of people.
I love that. Can you share some key findings from your research on how lifestyle factors like exercise and nutrition influence chronic diseases?
Sure. So I really do, I'll just kind of put this out there too, that I really have two lines of research at JMU. One is in this area of nutrition and exercise and the influence on chronic disease risk or biomarkers that are associated with chronic disease risk. The other one is much more true to my training in respiratory exercise physiology, which is kind of a focus of what we're doing now. So I can talk a little bit about both. So I'll answer your question first about
and
findings
also,
and what you asked about.
Yes, and when you're answering it, if you can elaborate on what some of the biomarkers are, that would be great.
I will, for sure.
And what is a biomarker?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I know, but people are like,
of course,
you know.
yes. And I love that too, because it's so important, especially if we can't get across what we're doing clearly, nobody is going to care. So you make sure you keep me honest. You say, come on.
I'll do my best.
So I'll say at first, you know, how we live, both nutrition and exercise, as you know from listening, the laughers, from listening to the rest of the podcast this month, as well as just what we know, how we live influences our risk for chronic disease. And I don't do large epidemiological studies where I'm looking at really large databases and seeing, you know, some of the things I'll talk about later, like physical activity patterns and risk for cardiovascular disease mortality. Mm-hmm. I don't do that kind of work. So I actually do like looking at acute interventions, and then, you know, that can tell us a little bit about if we respond in a adverse way after a single intervention, mm-hmm. then possibly in the long run, that can translate to our lifestyle habits. Mm. So what we might do is, you know, like if you go into the doctor's office, mm-hmm. I'm going to start off with kind of the biomarker.
That'd be great.
Idea. So if you go into the doctor's office, you go into your PCP, your primary care physician, they'll take your blood, and what do they usually measure in there? You know, like
glucose.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Lipid levels. Maybe mm-hmm. they'll take your
HDL,
your LDL. Mm-hmm. And then they'll just tell you, some of the time they don't even ask if you're fasted, right? They just are going to tell you whether or not usually you need to be on a statin, or mm-hmm. they might talk to you about lifestyle. And I'm not saying all PCPs, plenty are, you know, going to give more advice maybe.
Right.
But that's usually what happens. But actually, there's really good research that suggests that a post-prandial challenge, which is post-meal, so how the body responds to a single meal is a mm-hmm. better predictor of cardiovascular disease risk than just going in and taking fasting levels.
That's interesting.
It's very interesting. So what we do is we actually will give individuals a meal challenge, and yes, we give them a meal challenge. We see how they respond. There is a published threshold. Like we know a lot of the people listening may know their fasting levels, mm-hmm. but there's a published threshold above 220 milligrams per deciliter for triglycerides,
okay.
which is indicative of increased risk for myocardial infarction or heart attack and cardiovascular disease. Mm. So we see if people have this adverse response over this threshold. And then we see whether or not we can do either nutrition and create, you know, do something with that meal that's going to lower it. But more interestingly, I think, is what we do with exercise. So seeing, can we implement, if they're eating meals and having these adverse responses through the day, right? Because mm-hmm. most of the time we're not fasted. We're going to be in a postprandial state where we're eating or having a snack. So if you're constantly having this response over this threshold, maybe we can implement true-to-life exercise, physical activity, getting up and getting a short walk. Like, what is the dose that would be true-to-life that we could get individuals below this threshold? Mm. So we've done some work. I think the most interesting, you know, one study that we did, we found an amazing response in people who had older adults who had adverse metabolic responses to meal challenges, but they had to do it was over an hour of exercise the night before.
Wow.
You know, getting somebody to bike for an hour and a half, not eat anything afterwards, then they have the meal challenge and they have a response that's no longer adverse. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to know if someone will do that. Mm-hmm. So we ended up playing around with different doses and found that 30 minutes of postprandial walking. So you eat a meal mm-hmm. and then 30 minutes later you go for just a moderate intensity. So a walk where you'd be able to talk with a friend, but for 30 minutes, and about half of the people were then below that threshold. So we're doing some work now to, you know, understand what is it about those people that they really responded well to that bout of exercise. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the more interesting studies we've done recently.
Wow. Can I ask a couple of questions about that?
Please.
I'm sure there's some laughers out there going, meal challenge? What do you mean by a meal challenge? Like,
yes.
Walk us through, if you were going to give me a meal challenge, what am I doing practically to take on this meal challenge? Like, what does that mean?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
So in the literature, there has been so many different types of meal challenges. Is basically like what we would be doing every time we eat, is just we're sitting down and we're consuming a meal.
That's the
challenge? We don't think of it as a challenge, right? I love that you called that out, because in the research, that is just a sort of, because we're using it to elicit a response, mm-hmm. we're calling it challenge. But I like that you pointed it out, because all it is a typical meal. You're sitting down, they're coming to the laboratory, and they have 20 minutes to have some sort of food. Now, for these meal challenges or, mm-hmm. you know, a typical meal, we're actually using something that someone might not have first thing for breakfast.
Really? For example,
We use Marie Callender's chocolate satin pie. And I actually can't claim that I thought of the idea to use pie. In my PhD research, I was using, you know, like Jimmy Dean's breakfast bowl, something that might be more palatable in the morning, like eggs with potato or bacon. Mm-hmm. Eggs with sausage,
a biscuit,
and biscuits. And some of that has been done where people will have, you know, something like that, that they might have in an absolute amount. So I'm consuming, you know, two biscuits, mm-hmm. everyone consuming. We use this. So we use pie because the amount of fats in it mm-hmm. and sugars might be typical to what someone would have with a more westernized diet, we call in Western countries, that's mm-hmm. you know, higher in fat, higher in sugar. Mm. So even though it's pie, it's also very dense. So mm-hmm. it doesn't look visually, you don't think you're consuming that much, but calorically it is high. Mm. And that's why, you know, and people like it too. So when they come in, they're
a pie.
It's delicious. You know, sometimes with the leftovers with the graduate students, we're like, ooh, I could use just a couple bites here.
We need another study.
We don't want to waste it. So because of that, yeah. we use it, but we've used plenty of other things, but you're exactly right. It's just eating a meal. And then we're assessing the response afterwards.
Do they do the walk after the meal with you?
They do.
Okay.
For this, so we've done different studies. The one that I talked about before, they had to do a higher dose of exercise. Mm-hmm. That was actually an intravenous catheter study. So sometimes they will actually do, if it's a bike, it's a lot easier. They'll do that in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. And this one, it was great because they could just do it on the treadmill in the laboratory. And we made this study very true to life. Mm. So we had them actually self-select their speed. So it would be a speed they're comfortable at for doing a 30-minute walk.
To be able to talk, like you said
yes,
earlier.
Okay. Exactly. But we also made sure the energy expenditure, so how many calories they're burning in mm-hmm. this walk, was the same, you know, because we had several different conditions. So it was controlled, but also, again, you always want to keep a true-to-life nature of a study.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you're drawing the blood to check the biomarkers.
Exactly. So okay. We're drawing the blood. We are checking for triglycerides. We also were looking at LDL and HDL and glucose. But this specific study was more about triglycerides, blood triglycerides, since those ones are shown to have this very clear-cut clinical threshold.
Okay. And yes. Your findings, what's the impact of those findings for us? Talk to us about that.
I love that question, right? Because that research should always have some sort of
translatable
impact.
I feel like it should. Yeah.
It would be hard for me to do it if I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. So I think while I would love to think that if it made the biggest difference in our health to go have to ride for an hour and a half the night before we're going to eat at all, like all of us are going to end our day with an hour and a half of exercise. I know for me, that's not possible. I have
don't
a kids.
Think that's practical yeah. for a lot of us, unless you're an endurance athlete training for the long distance, that would make more sense. But the typical average person.
And what is this? Yeah. The top, 2%?
Right.
So I always want to try to think of what can impact human health and human well-being. And I think the translation of these findings is that, and it's actually sort of my first thought about health tips, is that something is going to be better than nothing.
Yes.
And there's a low, yeah. I mean, 30 minutes even, we're actually doing another study where we're trying to break it up throughout the whole day, and we're seeing really amazing pilot results of breaking up that 30 minutes into smaller chunks. Can it actually have really good metabolic outcomes on these, you know, levels throughout the day as we're continuously eating throughout the day? But something's going to be better than nothing mm-hmm. for improving your metabolic health and overall health, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a little bit.
I'm sure we will. But as you said, metabolic, one of the ongoing jokes, this is inside information.
Oh, geez. Hey, well, it's not going to be very inside anymore, Dawn.
Not at all.
I know.
Is that Steph loves the metabolic cart.
It was my first year here, and Chris, Dawn's husband, that was just so funny because I was down at the lab so much, you know, like after hours, I'd just be on the car, like, and Chris made a couple of jokes about how he was just waiting. You guys were waiting for a Christmas card with me and the metabolic card on it. So I do, you know, I do. Yeah, I do have a fondness of it.
Yes, you do. So for someone who's never seen or heard of a metabolic part.
There's
metabolic
parts
cart.
On the cart. Yeah.
Yeah, there are parts on the cart. Can you describe it for us, and what does it do, and and how you utilize it for your research?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a metabolic cart is going to measure metabolic outcomes. Like I'm talking about metabolic health right now, actually, as you know, more levels of these in our blood, which relate to cardiovascular disease risk. Mm-hmm. When we talk about metabolism using a metabolic cart, we're talking about oxygen consumption and CO2 production. So that's what you can get on a metabolic cart. Say, you know, we're kind of within this series throwing around the term fitness, right? Mm-hmm. And fitness level, if you're actually going to be able to have access to a laboratory, you can use a metabolic cart to measure how much oxygen you can consume. So that would be consumed from the atmosphere and then used to for energy. And then CO2 production. So that's the byproduct of metabolism.
Right.
So that's what a metabolic cart does. And it has a lot of other, you know, capabilities that someone may want to hone in on, like our breathing rates. So how much we're breathing during exercise, how big those breaths are, how much we're ventilating for a given oxygen or CO2. But that's expansive. In the short term, we can just measure something. Like we can put a name to fitness level by thinking VO2 or the amount of oxygen that we can consume and use for energy.
So is this metabolic cart present for all your studies?
So not all of them. Some of the ones I was describing actually before, the ones with, you know, just looking at some blood markers.
Yeah.
I don't always use a metabolic cart.
Okay.
I actually would, I might use it to get a better estimate of energy expenditure. However, because I would know then where they're working at compared to their total, you know, compared to their maximum. So I would be able to better quantify that, but not always. Sometimes we don't use those in those kind of studies. But in a lot of the studies that I was talking about with the other line of research looking at cardiorespiratory outcomes, I would use the metabolic cart because it's much more important for the outcomes of those studies.
I see. Makes sense. It does to me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Your work also examines how age and sex interact with lifestyle factors. Yeah. What have you discovered about these differences and their impact on our health?
Wait, so I'm sorry. Did you say how age what?
How age and sex interact with lifestyle factors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. So we have done quite a bit of different work, like in the study that I was just describing. I actually had transitioned from looking at younger adults and seeing different interventions. Like you give a younger adult a meal challenge and then see what dose of exercise will make a response.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they just don't have a big response to that meal challenge. Actually, that's fortunately.
Okay.
The younger people. So then we looked at, I'm going to kind of add in age, sex, and physical activity level.
Okay, that sounds
good. But as people get older, they just have an increased response to these meal challenges. Okay, so they have higher glucose and higher triglycerides with age. However, if they're active, that actually alone lowers the response. A really active older person can look much more like a younger inactive person.
Metabolically.
Okay? Yes, metabolically. So age makes, you know, age with physical activity level is really interesting, but age for a lot of things, I'm going to try to say this nicely, makes things worse. But not wisdom, that's for sure.
That's true.
But no, I do think, you know, physiologically, there's going to be some deterioration with age. A lot of that can be preserved with physical activity level. Our sex difference, the sex difference work that I have done has actually been a lot more with cardiovascular respiratory outcomes that I would be measuring like with the metabolic cart.
Okay. which she loves.
I do. Well, I know. Yeah. So I don't want to get too in depth, but we're doing a really cool rucking study right now.
Did you say rocking?
Rucking. So
like a rocking chair?
That would be cool. Rucking, and I was going to explain it. It's, you know how in the military, they would have to carry really heavy backpacks?
Yeah.
To, and they're just required because when you're on a mission, you're going to have to carry your supplies in your pack. And then the strap that goes over the front of the rucksack is what it's called. The backpack's called a rucksack. That strap is going to actually alter your breathing while you're having to do the ruck itself, right?
Okay.
So now it's just what they have to do. They have to carry their supplies.
Mm-hmm.
However, if those muscles responsible for breathing start to fatigue, they can actually, they elicit something called the metaboreflex. Okay. And that's really just fancy for saying they steal blood.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there's this blood flow needs to go to the leg so that they can continue to march.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they say encounter hostile forces or enemy, their first thing they're instructed to do is throw off that rucksack and then run.
Mm.
Okay. So if the muscles are fatiguing, then they actually, what they do, the respiratory muscles or the muscles in breathing, they win. They basically will take the blood from the legs, and then we might not be able to run as fast.
Wow,
so I bring this up because it's really interesting that females now fulfill the same combat roles in the military. They have the same absolute requirements, so they have to carry the exact same weight as males. Sometimes it equals their body weight, okay? But they have smaller lungs and airways. So we know respiratory muscles are more prone to fatigue. So it's really important that we understand. There's also different responses with that. When I said metaboreflex, they respond differently. Their body does when the muscles fatigue. But it's just so important that we are trying to, you know, our soldiers, that we are making sure that whatever we're telling them to do,
they can do it.
They can do. And it's the best for their health. It's the best for their safety.
Yes.
Right. So we're looking at responses in males and females. And then our next aim is going to be to try to improve the strength of those respiratory muscles. So that's really where the more of the sex difference work comes in that I'm doing.
Now with the aim, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
With this aim of increasing their respiratory muscles, what do you recommend that they do that?
Don, you ask such good questions. Well, it's like you have a background in exercise science.
I do.
Yes, you do. And did you know you're always going to go into comedy and podcasting?
No.
So
no.
Right.
It's a blast.
Yeah. Even this rucking work, you know, it really, and I'm not going to take credit for all the questions because Dan Bauer is at Virginia Military Institute. He kind of brought me down to incorporate some of the respiratory work.
What a great connection.
Such a great collaboration. That's what science is. It's just a series of these amazing collaborations. When we're trying to improve the strength of the respiratory muscles, we actually are right now working with an amazing company that makes respiratory muscle trainers. Some people have heard of them as inspiratory muscle trainers.
I haven't heard of those, actually.
You can get them you can even get them on Amazon. I have no disclosure, so I don't know about any company selling them. This specific company is called Power Breathe.
Okay.
And they are well established in the literature for having devices that you can get different types of resistance. And it's really hard because when someone's buying a device, they probably don't necessarily know what their maximum inspiratory pressure is. Meaning, I don't know how much force my inspiratory muscles can exert, right?
Right, yeah.
But I think you can kind of still, you know, it's hard to know whether respiratory muscles are actually a weakness in what somebody's doing. So it's almost like very specialized.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if somebody was trying to do respiratory muscle training, they could use one of these devices, and then they come with protocols. And it's, you know, you can easily look up online like a respiratory muscle strength protocol, which sometimes is just breathing against, it feels like it's not a closed valve, but it just feels like it's really hard to inhale. But they would do a max inhale, completely filling up their lungs for a certain amount of time or for a number of reps, just like we would do in the gym, but you're doing it on an actual trainer built for generating a certain resistance.
So similar people that have asthma, they have the smaller devices that help them increase their respiratory capacity. This is more elaborate.
Yes.
An extension of that or similar?
The device itself is, it's really small. It's really easy. I mean, they're coming up, like the company has been great to work with and they're interested in doing this study or at least helping us. So they've sent us a new digital trainer where I guess on your phone, you can actually see
that. We can do so many things today.
Oh my gosh. I know. I know. It's incredible. It's incredible. You know, all of this, the technology. And I know you asked somebody else about wearables. What we can do now blows my mind. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I think, you know, just sometimes you don't need to make things harder than they are. Trainers where they're generating a small resistance or large resistance, those ones are really quite easy too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I could have brought one down here. They're just sitting in my office.
Shoot.
Yeah.
Next time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I can send you pictures. You can post them on your social media.
There we go.
Okay.
And we might do that. We'll see.
Maybe I'll do it for my next Christmas card. The trainers.
That would be hilarious. Yeah. And we should just make it just for us.
Yes, I know. I'm going to one of these days.
We would get a kick out of that for sure. Now you've worked on the acute and chronic lifestyle interventions. And what do you think are the most effective strategies you've seen for disease prevention and management?
Oh, that's so I probably should stick just to my research, but I'm going to take my work and then can I expand it into the whole body?
Okay.
So for prevention and management, and I'm going to talk about this within like the larger scope of health and fitness tips. Being active. Mm-hmm. I mean, really being active is, if we think of all of the risk factors for lifestyle related diseases, there's a lot of modifiable risk factors, you know, like blood pressure is modifiable. And in some way, I know that there's also a genetic component to a lot of these or lipid levels. I mean, I have a very strong genetic component for high LDL. Even now.
Really?
Yes.
That's kind of surprising.
It is. Yeah. And you know, I mean, I know you know my mom and you see how active and lean. Yes. And she had a quadruple bypass in her 60s.
Oh,
and same thing with my grandma.
Okay.
And so, you know, I'm very diligent about it. But a lot of those modifiable risk factors of any of them, I think, physical inactivity, you'll see has the most supporting data for increasing the risk for cardiovascular disease mortality and all-cause mortality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, translating these findings of acute studies and seeing how much even a single bout of exercise can do, now make it a lifestyle, okay? Mm-hmm. So figure out a way to add activity or exercise into your day.
Yeah. That's true. And we've talked about this throughout the series, is be kind and compassionate to yourself. And if you set out to do 30 minutes and life happened and you can only do 10, then do the 10. 10 is better than none.
That's exactly right. And it's actually in a lot of people's mind, that's a really hard transition. It's easier to say than really buy in.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, I think in some ways I always have known that. But once I have a 3.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old.
She's busy.
Yeah, it is. It's a busy time. I'm a stepmom to three others who are 18, 17, and 14.
Yeah.
So now it really is a lifestyle. There are so many days where I will, and I know the importance of exercise, at the same time, truly getting in a run or a weightlifting session, I may not have prioritized for that day, or I just don't have time for in that day. So actually we'll go do a set of stairs. I'll go do a few wall squats or, you know, I just think it has to become a lifestyle. That's hard.
I love the way you said that too. I think that's a great perspective. It's just like, what can I do today?
Yeah, that's right.
Just a little bit every day adds up.
It really does.
Yeah.
And I think you start looking for more of those opportunities.
Yes, I think so too.
Right? Like we think we don't have time because we're sitting, you know, I'm going to my daughter's dance class tonight. I know I'm probably not going to have time for it. It's so cute. It's the cutest thing. And there's 30 minutes that she's in that dance class.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I think it's really easy to just say, those 30 minutes.
Yeah, I'm going to sit and watch.
I'm going to sit and watch. Or even if you're not, even if you're not sitting, you can even just stand and walk around while you're looking in periodically. That's all physical activity. It's not actually structured, but you're increasing your energy expenditure. That's not just sitting. It's so interesting because it really is the less time you have. Sometimes once you really start looking at what you can add in, it can be powerful too.
It can. You reminded me on the last episode that Dr. Mike Saunders was talking about as his kid was doing cross country. He was also exercising during that time.
Yes. Yes.
And other parents might have thought he was crazy, but that's what he was doing.
That could be. Yeah. Yeah. That's funny you say
he
that.
He didn't know.
Crazy.
But,
right.
But that's I think a normal thought. If you're doing something the rest of the group may not be doing, you might be thinking, be thinking I'm crazy.
Exactly. Then you realize a couple hours later, like, well, who cares? That's really a them problem, right?
Right.
You know, I was listening to, I can't remember if it was another a podcast or something I was reading. There is a giant in this field, meaning he's really well known in exercise physiology. He publishes a lot. Mm-hmm. He's actually an anesthesiologist by training. His name is Mike Joyner, and he's at the Mayo Clinic. He said that at his big talks, he's invited all over the world, and he actually brings a jump rope, and he'll outside of the talk or in the parking lot or in the airport,
he'll do a
little bit of jump rope. And not only is it so good for just getting in short effort, that's actually pretty intense. Jump rope is very difficult.
It is. People watching me might think it's a comedy routine.
Oh, right. Yeah. This is the best stand-up we've seen today. No, just kidding.
Fumbling all over myself.
Oh, I know. And then you hit yourself and you're like,
I admire people that get good at it. You can get good at it. I just probably just need to... stay after it.
Yeah. Well, maybe
have some skill level at it.
We should start off air jump roping, which is even better.
That's
for people
for
to watch.
Everyone around me. Yeah.
So, but I just thought that's so cool, and it's like if that's just what he does, and there's doesn't care about people around thinking, huh. I think it's more like, wow, he's really practicing what he believes in.
And self-care, he's taking care of himself.
That's right. That's probably more important for him in a lot of ways than the talk he's giving, since this
and
is
the stress
field.
Level too. Even if you love speaking in front of people, you care about it. There's some stress involved with that. You
start
know?
Off like
need one of those little respiratory
trainers.
That's right. What do you think are some of the common misconceptions people have about exercise and its role in preventing chronic diseases?
Misconceptions.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I think maybe people believe at first, at least, that it can kind of come in waves based on where you're starting at.
Right.
I think maybe people believe that there's more, that you have to do more than you actually have to do for any reduction in risk.
That is a good point. I like that you bring that up.
So, and I say this, I'm kind of conflicted when I say this because I do know the benefits of more activity and of a higher fitness level. And I believe in those. But at the same time, I present data the first day of my fitness assessment class that shows that from just being inactive to starting to be active is when you see the largest benefit in some health-related outcomes and reduction in risk. And then as you get more active and you can actually increase fitness, you'll see more reduction in risk. But I think sometimes when people think about starting exercise, it's kind of hard to wrestle with a lifestyle change that they might not want to do. So they just think, well, that level is so high that I'll accept where I'm at. When ultimately it really is, actually, if you can start being more active, you're going to start seeing the reduction in risk, and that's just going to beget more activity.
And you're going to feel better, and you're going to want to do more.
That's right. And it'll overflow to all aspects of your health. And I talk about that. Yeah.
I love that you brought that up, because I think we're too hard on ourselves, and we want to get to the end result as quick as possible. So as a result, we go oftentimes out too hard. And then yes. that can lead to a lot of things, including injury and that's quitting right. because it's that's just not thing. Fun anymore, you know? And so,
yes. If you're not enjoying the process,
you got to enjoy it. Yeah.
You're not going to stick with it, right?
That's right.
So you're absolutely right. And then yeah. I think, I can't remember which one, because from the time you had asked me to do this, and then yeah. I started listening to the podcast, it's wonderful.
Thank you.
So I can't remember which person said it, but it really is so much about loving that process.
Yeah.
And really evaluating how you're feeling during it.
Yes.
It can't be only outcome oriented.
I actually think that might be the other Funny Womack, my husband.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think
well,
so.
I knew I liked back. Him. He's got great advice, if I may say so myself.
I think so. Yeah, you want to become the person that wants to exercise versus the person that's checking it off their list and, you know.
That's right. That's right.
It's not as enjoyable or fun, and it's hard to stick to something like that. That's why those the fad diets and all of those things are not sustainable.
Yes.
And similarly with exercise, it's you want to develop an exercise or fit exercise in your lifestyle in a way that makes you happy and brings you joy
That's right.
and gives you energy.
That's right.
And you may have to try a few things before you figure out what that is.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And I think you're so right about beating yourself up.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's one of those things that when I was younger, maybe I would know all of this. But now, the phase of life I'm in, I really do just completely buy in, you
yeah.
know, to finding enjoyment in moving, yeah. in moving our body and finding ways each day to be able to do that in a way that we're really... you know, that's making us better in every area of our lives.
Yeah. And I think being kind to ourselves that it can change with the seasons of life.
Yes.
So before you became a mom, your exercise activity and things that you did probably look a little bit different.
They do. Yeah.
You know, and now that yeah. you're doing different things because of your kids right. are now in your life.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. And I still, you know, I think it still is really important to set goals, mm-hmm. right? But the way you can kind of think about those goals doesn't have to be, okay, if I don't do something that I had planned on doing this day to reach my goal, like that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it's okay. And there's a lot of days, this phase of life that we're in is beautiful, but it also comes with a lot of unexpected illness and yeah. we're having to be really adaptable. I mean, we have so many calls from daycare about, you know, oh, they have a fever today and it looks a lot different. So, you know, if that day then is going to be, okay, I can do, you know, this amount and it mm-hmm. looks different than the plan, there is no part of me that feels like that is a failure. Right.
Yeah, no.
And I think it's really important that to have a healthy relationship with how we view exercise, we feel like that.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. For someone just beginning their health journey, what are the first steps you recommend for incorporating this exercise and healthy nutrition into their lifestyle?
So they're just starting?
Yeah, they're just starting.
Okay.
Or restarting in my case.
So, well, that's beautiful too, because I'm sure you've done, you know what you want to do.
Yeah.
And you know, you have the tips
yeah.
and the drive that you're going to
do it.
Do
yeah.
it. Yeah. 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 And we all are at some point going to go through those phases with an injury where we are restarting or mm-hmm. a different goal where we are restarting. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's just the cycle of life.
Of life. Yeah. yeah.
And in some ways, I don't have a major fitness goal right now. So when I do, I'll be restarting, mm-hmm. you know? So it's hard because if someone is starting, would this person be starting from maybe not exercising
yes,
at all?
Not exercising at all.
Okay. So, not exercising at all as well as nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a dietitian, but I can say just what I truly like my ethos is here.
Oh, that'd be great.
So not doing it at all, I think start looking at your entire day. Mm-hmm. Okay. And look at maybe what are, potential barriers for you in the past with having done more.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So like you are right now not exercising and there's probably a reason for that. Is it something that it's truly because you haven't found enjoyment in? Is mm-hmm. it, you know, so do some evaluation of yourself before you're going to think about a change. Mm-hmm. And then identify the barrier. So like for me, I actually... I shouldn't admit this on air. I don't like showering. I like showering at the end of the day. I don't like going into like my classes. Some people work out right in the middle of the day and then they don't mind not showering before class. And I think for some females, it just can take longer to get ready. So for me, like barriers in the day would actually be having to do exercise and then figure out when to work in a shower before I might teach, you know, so just like, look,
you like to do it after.
Yeah. I like to do it at the very end of the day.
You know, so and that works for you.
It works for me. Yeah. So I think but it's also personal. So identify barriers before and like what has prevented this activity or this lifestyle change, and then start working with those. So actually write it out, do the exercise of writing your barriers. You know, why haven't you done it before? Is it that you felt like you're too busy now? You know, are you making this lifestyle change because you've gotten poor news about health? Right. So just I think writing out your barriers and then figuring out a way in a really actionable way to get started. You know, I think saying right away, it's okay to say I'm going to run a marathon in a year, right? Like, or I'm going to run a marathon in a few months. But I think like you said,
a few months,
you know, depending on where we start.
Depending on where you start. Yeah. Indeed. I wouldn't recommend doing a marathon in a few months if you haven't done anything.
But some people will do that and then be so intense about a plan, And that is maybe harder to actually maintain than if you start figuring out where in the day can you work in exercise. Like, for example, when we got here or when you came in with the equipment, we had two opportunities to go up and down stairs. Mm-hmm. And we did that, right? Yeah. Even though it was kind of a pain to carry all the equipment.
It was extra. This is great. It's extra steps.
It's extra steps. So I think some people actually, once they're identifying some barriers, now we can easily try to figure out in our day where we can work in more. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I think just starting there. And the same thing comes from nutrition. You know, I did some work. I didn't mention this in my PhD. I had this amazing experience. And I think partly because of just I'm so curious. Mm-hmm. I collaborated a lot with a nutrition consortium. It's just a nutrition center that does research. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, so I'm not a nutrition researcher. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of times when people are trying to get started with nutrition changes, they get lost in the details without focusing on the fundamentals. Most people know how to eat healthy, right? Like we know plants are better than chips.
Right.
You know, we know an apple is going to be better than a donut.
Yeah.
And there's so much nutrition information, but I think actually there's way more ways to have a nutritious diet than people believe. So I think, you know, trust in the fundamentals, eat more plants. This is one of my health tips. Really, if you trust in these fundamentals, that's how I would say is get started before you get lost in all of the details about, oh, this fad exercise or fad diet. Mm-hmm. So those little lifestyle changes actually are forming the entire base of your pyramid.
That is the power, I think, in getting healthier right there is making the lifestyle changes.
Yes.
Versus signing up for a program, a fad diet. It's very hard to sustain that. And there's a lot of research and evidence out there that the yo-yo dieting, you can end up gaining more weight than before, and now you have a bigger challenge, and it's just a never-ending cycle.
And it feels bad, right? It never feels good to be on those kind of cycles. Like, no. I think so much of what we're talking about with true lifestyle changes is like our relationship with it. So our relationship with exercise and physical activity, if we completely buy in, it's going to feel, you know, like just moving is going to start feeling natural and feel good. It's the same thing with food. Mm-hmm. If we have a healthy relationship with it, then it's going to start just feeling better, even when we're eating the things we enjoy, you know?
That's right. Yeah. It's coming down to choices. And that doesn't mean you can't ever have a donut or pie or chocolate or anything else. Yeah. That's all. Moderation is key.
That's right.
It's just looking at your whole day too. I've started doing that. So if I know, for example, we're going to go out Friday night and we're going to go to Palfire and have the pizza. Mm-hmm. Maybe for lunch, I'm going to have more, you know, protein and veggies.
That's right.
And same thing for the morning so mm-hmm. that I have a greater capacity in my caloric intake for that day fun when I go to Pale Fire and eat my pizza.
And I think it's so important too. Yeah. Absolutely. And I love Pale Fire's pizza.
I love it. I highly recommend.
I just
and they didn't pay us to say that.
No. No conflicts of interest. And, you know, I think too, because especially having a 3.5 and a 1.5 year old, I really want them to have a nutritious diet, but also a healthy relationship with food. And if we have mac and cheese now, they love mac and cheese. Not too many kids don't like mac and cheese.
Yeah.
But I will try to offer up several fruit mm-hmm. options and vegetable options. And same thing with Pale Fire. I mean, I guess not too often, you know, would you maybe get a side of steamed broccoli, but maybe you could do like a side salad and then have less of the pizza, which usually it's like a pretty, you know, you can split that. And I just think it's if we can kind of do this where we're not saying, oh, I had pizza, so I failed in my diet. That's not a good relationship. That's not going to lead to, I think, long-term changes that will be the best for us.
I agree. And for those laughers that are not familiar with Pale Fire, because you may not be in Harrisonburg, it's Harrisonburg. It's a brewery.
Yes.
It's a lot of fun.
They
have great pizza.
Yeah. Actually, I've met a new group of, you know, most of them are moms with kids similar ages.
Okay.
And we are starting a book club because that's what like cool moms do on Friday nights. And we're going to do our first one at Pale Fire. I'm like, this is awesome. So maybe I'll see you in there next Friday for book club.
There we go. And we'll say hi when we come
exactly.
eat the pizza.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I will be having pizza and probably a beer.
I have a question for you personally in your career. What challenges have you faced as you have done all this work? What are some of the biggest challenges?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I mean, this is in some ways low-hanging fruit. To me, the biggest challenge has just been I'm so passionate about this field and about teaching. I love research. I love mentorship. So I love all of the aspects of my job. Like coming to work is a treat. I mean, I really do. It's like they have that saying that if you love work, if you love work so much,
you'll never work a day in your life. I have a friend who says that all the time.
You know what's so funny is Mike Saunders always makes fun of me that like I mess up every saying. So I had to mess up one on a podcast.
Oh, and by the way, laughers, we are at James Madison University and there is some sort of class. No. It sounds like a bunch of male athletes.
It does.
Out there.
I'm hearing like hoorahs and maybe it's the ROTC. Actually.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is. So that's what you're hearing if you hear that.
Very excited about their workout. Very excited about physical activity, perhaps.
It does sound kind of military.
It does. It does. Yeah. And I know they had a few. We were actually over there recruiting. They had a few things coming up. So maybe they are. So anyways, I love the work that we do here.
Yeah.
And because of that, time just doesn't feel like it's enough. And before I had children, I know I could work at home, but now I have also this conflict. I don't want my kids to see me on a computer or phone from the time it feels like very few hours from the time they get home from school till night. And lately I feel like, you know, have my computer out a couple days a week. And that actually is creating I would say a little bit of guilt. I just really try to be intentional about shutting it off. So time is just really difficult because I know at the end of my workday now until they go to sleep is not work time for me. So I have to be done with the day when I leave. But I also have so many things I want to do that it's really hard to have the very best classes that I can have. And, you know, do the best I can with mentoring students through their theses, which is, you know, through their student research projects and writing. So that's
juggling the time of parental and family responsibilities with the career.
Yes.
So you're overcoming it by setting some boundaries, I see.
That's right.
With turning off the computer and the phone so that you can be present with your family when you're with your family.
That's right.
Okay.
It's, you know, I think most people have this issue with lifestyle changes as well as time is at least reported as the largest barrier.
It's a commodity for sure.
It is. Yep. And there's so many things that we want to do. So we really have to prioritize what we want with that time. So I found to be continuing to get better at that. But that is the biggest challenge, is just within a work day, getting everything done that I really want to do and figuring out what to prioritize. There was another saying, Dr. Mike Saunders, that when you're juggling a bunch of balls, you have to figure out which ones are rubber and which ones are glass.
Oh,
so which ones are
going
to fall and then they'll break. And then which ones actually you don't need to get done at that minute because they're going to bounce back up.
That's good.
So yeah, sometimes I've realized that I can just want to do things that are more like rubber balls, but actually those things are not the ones that need to get done the most. So I'm learning, and I actually, as I just took over as the grad program director this fall.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a time that we have a lot going on. We're having major changes in our curriculum, and we just had this review of our whole program where external people came in to review
that.
It. Mm-hmm. So figuring out what things have deadlines, like things that we just previously this semester and last semester had to do, versus what things actually I just want to do can be postponed a bit. So that's a challenge, but it is
a challenge, but you're getting through it.
That's right. And we're all learning. What else would we be doing if we're not learning?
Yeah. I think sometimes too, the challenges that we face, well, oftentimes help us really grow as a person and learn more about ourselves.
For sure. I mean, even this podcast, I've never been on a podcast, and I thought my initial thought one was about just time, because we have, you know, a search going on and we had just gotten over a lot of illness, which I thought it was a little bit ironic too. Like, I was so sick when I was going to be talking about health, but I knew it was something that would like stretch me a little and maybe make me a little bit like uncomfortable in a really good way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's actually what you said is really resonates, because I now more seek out those opportunities than I would have before.
Yeah, and you'll find oftentimes that you get past the challenge, it'll be like, that wasn't so bad.
Right, yeah. Maybe I'll love it so much, I'll be hitting you up every week. Hey, you need a guest? I'm just kidding.
Or can we do another podcast?
Yeah. Although sitting down with you, it feels like we're just out having a coffee.
Right?
Yeah, that's fun. That's how you are with everybody.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm sure that's why people come on and then they end up enjoying it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I love people and I love learning about people. It's one of the biggest joys lately, and it's my own career development, is doing this podcast. We have so many amazing people here in the Shenandoah Valley that are doing so many amazing things.
I think, well, I heard this somewhere.
Yeah.
Curiosity is the biggest compliment. And I think it's so true. Like, I, you know, sometimes some of my in-laws joke that, like, I just pepper with questions. And I try not to, but I really do get so genuinely curious about humans and like who you are and why you're the way you are.
Yeah, what makes you tick?
Exactly.
So, what's your story?
Exactly.
How did you get here?
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's just, it comes so natural that, you know, I love it too so much.
Yeah, it's important. I think really the essence of every human being is curiosity. I really do. I would think we all want to learn.
Yeah.
And we desire to be better. And we have different challenges, environmental, socioeconomic, and different things. But the essence of us is we seek to learn and we want to be better.
And I think what you just said is really what I try the most in mentorship to do, is get students really excited about being curious rather than having anxiety about the outcome, because they're so scared about where they're going to end up that they're not being really excited about the curiosity they're feeling in their process. Like, hey, let's say this is an example from last year, but somebody just started in class talking about blue zones. And, you know, these are these areas where in the world people are living over 100 years old, like kind of this dense geographic area.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, I just saw you get so excited about that. And it was so cool, because she's like, oh yeah, that is like the most excited I've been about anything recently. She ended up doing an internship in Costa Rica, a blue zone.
Okay.
Yeah. Follow that curiosity.
Follow curiosity, and I'm going to follow it right now. Blue zones are where people 100 years old well, so, or live to 100 years old? What are we talking about here?
Yeah. So I only know, I'm glad you followed up. So I mean, I don't, this is not an area I know much about at all. There is a Netflix show called Blue Zones. And it says in these certain geographic areas, they're kind of trying researchers or, you know, I'm not sure they're all researchers, but people are trying to understand why in this geographic location are people living really long lives.
Interesting. So, okay.
It's very cool. And some of it, you know, they focus on nutrition in the region. They had a region in Italy that was one of the most, people had the very highest physical activity into old age.
That's
because
great.
Just their infrastructure, a ton of steps and stairs and, you know, the walking that they had to do.
So the community is set up to encourage physical activity, like the infrastructure is.
Yes, and they had somebody on there too. Okay. I know you'll love this. It was a woman, and she was talking about the region, and she was talking about focusing on when they're getting together with family. She talked about laughter.
Oh, yeah, that's important.
Yes, so
laughter is a great medicine.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah. You want to live long and live a good life. Be happy and laugh a lot.
That's right. And you can even burn calories when you laugh.
Yeah,
I'm not a ton, obviously.
I know, yeah.
Otherwise, I'd be already 20 pounds lighter.
Could you imagine watching a cross-country practice and just seeing someone, you know? I'm not going to get extra steps in. I'm just going to stand here and laugh as much as I can in 20 minutes.
But, I wish it worked that way. Yeah. But you do burn some calories when you laugh, for real.
That's right. And it just feels really good.
It does feel good. Yes. I love it so much. I want to ask you, you know, you've mentioned some of the tips, but let's summarize it for our viewers and our laughers.
Okay.
What are your top five health and fitness tips?
Yes.
Drum roll.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Nice. I don't know if anybody else got a drum roll. So the first one, I actually, even on the way to campus for this, was kind of debating how to phrase it because originally I was thinking, so I'm going to say both.
Sounds good.
Have exercise as your base before you think about the toppings. And I was kind of trying to do like a fun little maybe food reference.
Yeah, I love it.
But I actually want to make it a little more negative.
Interesting take.
No, I don't know. I don't know about negative. But I just want to, I think it actually better summarizes what we talked about with just getting started. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say is this, avoid inactivity. Mm-hmm. Avoid inactivity. So, you know, I'm just going to really quickly mention a research study that I think is pertinent and important. It was in a journal called the Journal of American Medical Association, or JAMA. And this is one of the top medical journals.
Very well known.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It was the largest study I've seen where they looked at modifiable risk factors for cardiovascular disease mortality and all-cause mortality. Things like, again, hypertension, blood pressure, blood lipid levels, physical inactivity. And they also had people's fitness levels. And this study, I think, is the most convincing. They broke up these people who had, you know, this really large cohort who had died from either all-cause mortality or cardiovascular disease, and then broke them up into quartiles. So the least fit were from 0 to 25%, second least fit 25 to 50, second most fit were the 50 to 75th percentile, and then the very most fit were 75th and above. Mm-hmm. And the very least, so the least active people who were virtually not doing anything, had five times the risk of all-cause mortality and cardiovascular disease mortality. That equaled something like 400% greater risk. But it even was from the 0 to 25% who were really low, you know, virtually doing nothing, to the second most fit was like 2.75 times the risk, ended up being like 140 or 150% greater risk if you're that low compared to even being, you know, compared, you don't have to be the very most fit even.
Yeah.
And it was like that with each group comparison. And what's so convincing about the data is that they actually looked at all of those other risk factors I talked about, blood pressure and lipids, smoking, and physical inactivity was the best predictor, was the most...
Over all of those?
Over all of the others.
Wow.
You know, there's some physiologists, exercise physiologists, who would argue that it's the most important modifiable risk factor. So that's the first one. And I don't want to sound, I actually think it's kind of positive, hopefully, rather than negative, to say that's avoid inactivity.
That's what you meant by negative, is the avoid word.
Yes.
Got it.
But it really is, you know, when you talked about someone just getting started, it's that data. Now, to get to the highest group, now we may need to start focusing on actually not just moving, but moving in a way that's really going to bring our heart rate up. So within the avoid inactivity, you could start getting more, it's not even nuanced, but more specific. Like start, okay, now that you've made it a lifestyle, start incorporating things like strength training. Start incorporating exercises that are going to increase your heart rate. But that's a good first one, is avoid inactivity.
That's a great tip. That's your number number five or number one? Which way are we going?
Oh, we can say number one. I mean, I think of this as a horizontal. There I we really go. Do. Yeah.
All right. So we're on the same page.
Instead of a vertical scale, I mean, I think of it as they're all this really all almost equal. But that one, since, you know, this is our field, I think it's,
Okay, so number one tip, avoid inactivity.
Yes.
Number two.
This one I've already mentioned, so it'll be quick too, is eat a nutritious diet. Focus on the fundamentals before getting lost in the details.
Oh, that's good.
How many people, now what I hear, and you know, I hear it not just from friends. I don't have a TikTok or an Instagram. But I certainly am working with students whose lives are on there. And what they ask and what they share is really sometimes tough to stomach. Because I know it's hard for younger people not to buy in, and even older people, I'm sure. How often even we have a friend who's, you know, had amazing results on a keto diet. Well, if you don't enjoy eating that way, if that doesn't work for your lifestyle, there's just so many different diets that can work for somebody. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, if we know the fundamentals, then a lot of different things can work for different people. And it doesn't have to get into these details that really are not going to make something work at all or make it sustainable.
Or give you stress.
That's right.
I mean, elite athletes, that's a whole different ball game. They have to get very meticulous and, you know, pay attention to the detail about grams and of all the different carbohydrates and fats and proteins. But I think for most of us, you know, the fundamentals is a great way. If we focus on that, we can improve our nutrition by a lot.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a dietitian. I know Dr. Akers was on the show and we've collaborated, and I have worked, you know, I try to get nutritionists or dietitians on projects because I don't have the expertise.
I think that's wise.
Yeah. But at the same time, I do look in the literature enough, and I at least feel like this, and this is, you know, maybe it eventually will come to bite me, but how I'm feeling at this current moment is it's a lot easier to discern effects when looking at the exercise data that being active is going to reduce your risk drastically for cardiovascular disease or metabolic diseases. With diets, if you're looking at risk for diseases, okay, or looking at risk for all-cause mortality or cardiovascular disease mortality, different diets, it's so conflicting. There's so much different,
different information, conflicting information out there. Yeah.
It's so hard to discern different effects. Because of that, I truly believe that if you adhere to it and it's nutritious, it can work. And, so that's, I think, just really important because so much is out there with
I
this topic.
I think so too. And while we're on it, before we move to tip number three, if we can just kind of summarize in your point of view what those fundamentals are.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So eat more plants. Okay. So eat more vegetables and eat more fruits. If you're going to choose, you know, you can do whole grains for, you know, compared to, if you're trying to choose between brown rice and white rice, you can choose brown rice. I think eating nuts and seeds. So those things, like for me, incorporating more plants is the, you know, that really works for me and what our lifestyle is. I also think, you know, like high quality sources of protein. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to have like lean chicken breast mm-hmm. or something like that, or if you like having a more plant-based diet, tofu and tempeh. So I think a lot of times there's just these things we go into the store and we know, I think it was also Chris who was saying, you know, like if you shop around, in the aisles and around, it's kind of a general rule of thumb. But we also all know that plants like broccoli and kale and spinach, incorporating those things in a way that we like, we actually enjoy the taste of, is going to be better for us than maybe getting a can of broccoli cheddar soup that lasts for probably 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying there's not a place ever for having to do something quick, but just the fundamentals of incorporating those foods that are better for us, it's going to make it just seem a lot easier to make lifestyle changes.
Yes, and just a practical tip of one way to do that I've found enjoyable that will get more vegetables in your day are smoothies.
Absolutely. Nick is my husband.
And those are fun and they taste good.
They are. And for me, you know, I actually incorporate some protein in those too.
Yeah.
And I think
they have protein powder. You can dump a couple of scoops in.
Right. Yeah. And you can make them taste mm-hmm. really good. And sometimes if you're feeling like you need a little extra sweet, I'll add a few like scoops of Nutella. And yeah. that doesn't, you know.
That's really yeah. great. And you can mix the fruits and the veggies. So
that's right.
I've done, you know, strawberry, blueberry, but put the kale in there.
Kale.
Mix it all up. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty good. I actually like this.
That's
tastes
awesome.
Great.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of ways to incorporate the things we know are good in ways that we also really enjoy, which I think if you're not enjoying it, again, like you said, you're not going to stick to it. Mm-hmm. If your friend went keto and lost, you know, 50 pounds, if that's a goal even, maybe it's just that you want to try something different, but you don't, that's something that feels
that's
really
not
difficult.
Resonating with
it's
you.
A, yeah, you're yeah. on it. And even if you're having yeah. success,
yeah.
but you don't like it, guess what? You're not going to stick with it. So
no, that's yeah. the key on that too for nutrition yeah. as well.
Yeah.
And there's no cookie cutter way. We're all so individual. And there's some more and more research, you know, two different people could eat the same, actually, foods.
That's right.
And have different responses. Reactions and responses to it.
I love that you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Because that's another thing is, you know, to know something is working for you is also starting to really, like, look at your health.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I talked a little bit about cholesterol levels, about LDL.
Mm-hmm.
And if people have data about themselves that they can track something, you know, say that they're getting older and now they're getting more concerned about blood markers and they're seeing their glucose.
Mm-hmm.
There's such good methods now to track glucose. You can mm-hmm. go to the doctor and get it, but there's over-the-counter blood glucose monitors mm-hmm. and you can get more information on yourself to see what's working for you.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so true because that's so true that certain things don't work for mm-hmm.
Yeah.
for people. And that's really what the data shows.
Yeah.
That, and that's why it's so hard to discern effects. I don't believe there's any very best diet. Mm-hmm. I really don't. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, Dr. Akers, if you disagree. you're the expert, but I am just going off of what I have read and believe.
So, yeah. And yeah. you got to find what works for you. So that is number two, right?
Yeah.
So number three.
Number three, this one is one I think you will enjoy.
Oh, I like it.
I'm going to say that, I'm debating how to say it, mental health is the yeah. cornerstone of overall health.
Yeah.
So prioritize mental health. I just think all of these, especially like exercise and mental health and exercise, they have role, you know, they have so much overlap. Mm-hmm. And I think, but mental health just in general, we should always be working to feel better about, I'm trying to think of a good way to say it, but our place in the world, because
yeah.
I don't know if you can really value a health span. You know, health span we think of as, so health span is the total amount of years that you're living healthy in your total life.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a physician would say that it's years that you're spent free of disease and disability.
Mm.
But I think it might have been Mike Joyner. It was somebody, I can't remember. It might have been Peter Attia, who's someone who does some really good medical and physiology podcasts, all sorts of things. But I think he said actually how it could be viewed as your amount of years that you can enjoy and engage in the things that you want to throughout your life. So the healthy years that are, I mean, free of disease and disability,
yeah.
People wouldn't be so passionate about living long if you weren't really enjoying them. And for me, enjoying them is really if you feel good about your place in the world and you are, you know, and that comes in so many forms. It has to be what works for somebody. It could be meditation. It could be mindfulness practice. It could be journaling. I think it's really important to be playful and deepen social connections and have friendships that are deep.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't just go with fitness because I think that there's so much overlap with fitness and physical activity and anxiety and depression and other goes both ways, but mental health is critical. So I had to have that on there.
Yeah, I think I don't remember which previous episode, probably with one of the counselors we've interviewed before, but there's a book out there called The Body Keeps Score.
Yes.
And how trauma is stored in our body and paying attention to our mental health and improving our mental health actually helps us release those traumas. Because when they're stored in your body can actually lead to chronic disease.
That's right. I listened to another podcast with Ellen Langer. She is she's a psychologist and she actually is a professor at Harvard.
Yeah.
She's called the mother of mindfulness.
Oh, really?
But she has a book.
What's her name again?
Ellen Langer,
okay,
L-A-N-G-E-R. The podcast was awesome. And she actually went as far when you talk about some physiological responses. Mm-hmm. I'll say this just really quick because I think like the listeners would be really interested. They did a study, and this just shows like how we feel can influence what happens so much.
In our body. It's very connected. Yeah. It's all connected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they had people, this is such a deceptive study. They had people coming in to a room where they set it up. It was like a doctor's office. Like they set up, or no, it was an intake room before they were coming into the research study.
Mm-hmm.
So they told them, just wait in the intake room until you come in for the interviewing for this research study.
Yeah.
Well, in that intake room, they had, somebody who was like a research assistant who was set up to be sneezing. They had another research assistant set up with the mask on.
Mm-hmm.
They had like tissue boxes in there. They had a screen playing about, you know, the most something about common colds going around. And it was like an alarming amount of people that had developed colds after that.
Interesting.
So, you know, she had a control condition as well,
right.
People in the intake room, and then they followed up with them after. So the control condition
would
be
inputting this information.
Yes.
Suggesting.
So it's we think of it as, you know, our physiology sometimes influences our mind, and it's honestly, the results, I need to read the study because I just listened to this maybe 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
So I need to look at the data, you know, but I'm sharing it probably preemptively almost. But at the same time, I believe what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Our mind can influence our physiology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and people who have really high rates, it works both ways. Like people who are sick have high rates of anxiety and depression, but also it's not causal in just that direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's just really important. To focus on.
I agree. What's number four?
Number four is prioritize sleep.
Oh my gosh.
So
yes.
I don't know if I actually don't think anyone else has talked about it, and I'm not a sleep expert.
It's so important.
Well, and you know, you can go 30 days without food. You can go 30 days without exercise. Neither would we want to go 30 days without probably, but you cannot go 30 days without sleep. I think the Guinness Book of World Records might be 24 days, and they actually cut the study off. I'm pretty sure I heard that.
They would need to.
Right. So, you know, I don't know how you used to be when you were younger. When I was in my PhD program, I was one of those I'll sleep when I'm dead sort of people. And it's like you can outrun. The only one of the few things like everybody needs to do. And you need to do it to be able to actually engage in the physical activity you want to.
Mm-hmm.
You need to do it to have good mental health.
Yes,
and,
you do.
So I think aiming for 7 to 9 hours of sleep seems to be, you know, kind of this magic window, and it has to be sleep that's actually quality sleep, like you're not just laying in bed for 8 hours, and that can be an issue in itself, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, prioritizing sleep.
Yes. And so sharing something personal here, but also I think can be helpful is I have complex PTSD from a trauma history,
okay.
which has led me to reading The Body Keeps Score.
Yes.
So somebody out there probably may be going through this that's listening to this. One of the symptoms is nightmares, and that wow. affects your sleep.
Wake cycle, for sure, yeah, right?
Tremendously. Yeah. So improving your mental health
yeah.
actually helps you heal.
Yeah.
And I don't have the nightmares that I used to have by spending the time on my mental health. And so my sleep
That's
is now
amazing.
Better.
Yeah, because it is deep sleep that I think is like yeah. serving as its own sort of therapy, you know, where yeah. we're processing on a lot of emotions and a lot yeah. of what's going on during the day. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible story. Because
they were horrific. But it's part of the physiology of recreating. You're trying to solve what
exactly.
happened to you.
Yes.
So you're kind of co-creating. It's coming in the form of... or recreating, and it's coming in the form of nightmares.
Yeah.
So once you start getting to the root of what happened to you, and you start
exactly.
processing it, and you
yeah.
start integrating
yeah.
that, and you can get to a point where you're experiencing post-traumatic growth, which is what I'm going through right now, which now I can sleep.
Yeah. But amazing that yeah. you are doing that work.
Yes, you have to do the work. Not exactly easy, but to anyone out there, friends, it's totally worth it. It's not as bad as you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing about your brains, just like ours here, is it has great capacity for neuroplasticity.
Yes.
Which means...
That's so true.
You know, you may have been through years of things, but your healing process will be much shorter. And I can guarantee you that as
yeah.
my own personal testimony.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. It yeah. was so good to hear too, because related experience mm-hmm. is a lot of times what also can, you know, drive changes. And it's not always easy to sit with that yourself.
Right.
So yeah, that's yeah. awesome.
That's why you don't want to touch it, because it was painful the first
yeah.
time around,
uh-huh.
which makes you hesitant to talk to somebody about it, because
right.
you feel like, I don't want to go back there.
Right.
But the way over is through.
Yes.
So...
That's one of my favorite sayings. It actually is.
Yeah.
And it really is. And I think if you just really buy into that, then the long run is, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel, for sure.
Yeah. And then you have new ways of being, and you feel so much better. So if someone's listening going, I don't know if I should go to the therapist, I don't want to talk about this, go talk about it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there is something too. And I think... Yeah, therapy is incredible, but even
yeah.
just engaging in mm-hmm. dialogue,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's like, for us, this feels so natural.
Yeah.
And
we're connecting. Yeah.
I think for some people, just like, it's very difficult for them to engage in dialogue about how they're feeling and about, you know, things that'll actually lead to improvements in overall mental health. So figuring out a way to get there is also so valuable, because you're
yeah.
just going to feel so much better about yourself.
And like exercise, just get started. You don't have to have it
that's
all
right.
figured out. I promise you.
That's right.
Yeah.
yeah, that's so true. I mean,
yeah.
You can start doing 10 minutes of journaling a day. You know, I'm not doing it every night, but when I feel like I really need to sit with something,
mm-hmm.
I will get out a journal and I'll write. And I love it. I think it's such a powerful exercise, and like
yeah.
just thinking about how I'm thinking. And yeah, so that's been really great.
So prioritize sleep.
Yep.
So we've had, I think we're on our fifth
on
one.
On our fifth one. And this one could be quick, or we could just go off of it for another hour. But I think with all of these, it kind of culminates into
yeah.
enjoyment. So find enjoyment.
Yes.
You have to find what you enjoy with physical activity. You have to find what you're enjoying with food. You have
mm-hmm.
to find how you're getting healthier mentally. And you really have to, when you're prioritizing sleep, I think, well, that's just the easiest thing to enjoy when we sleep well. Isn't it?
It's pretty
cozy.
Oh,
I feel so good about the day because I slept so well.
And you have energy.
That's right. I mean, last night was, I do track my sleep. I had 0 minutes of awake time. For me, that's so unusual. I usually have a child up in the middle of the night still.
Mommy.
But also, yeah, not you anymore.
No,
maybe
mine's
one 31. Calls. Yeah, he might still call you. Hey, you might, you know, everyone needs your mom. But
yeah,
I do think, I do think that that's, you know, I just notice the days that I'm feeling good.
And yeah.
0 minutes of awake time is very rare for me.
Yeah. So enjoyment.
Enjoyment. Yes. Just find enjoyment. And that's what's going to lead to changes that you may want to see, is by finding the things that you enjoy.
The things that you enjoy doing to be physically active, yep.
Nutrition,
how you eat, find ways to enjoy that.
Find ways to enjoy mental health. Maybe that'll be coming to a comedy show because you feel good when you're laughing with
friends.
What
a great idea, Steph.
Yes.
Come to a FWAF show.
A FWAF show.
This podcast is brought to you by a FWAF show.
Yeah.
Funny Womack and Friends.
That's
you
right.
are the AF and FWAF.
Yes.
So all you AFers, come to the show.
I love that. AFers.
And that is a great way to do that. But not just comedy. We have, you know, in our community and lots of communities throughout the world, there's live music.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, there's things that you can do. We have a great adult improv troupe here called Rocktown Improv.
Yep.
I believe they perform first Fridays at Court Square Theater monthly. Yep. I mean, there's tons of things you get. There's paint and sips, and there's on our podcast, there's tons of different things that couples and people and individuals and friends can do.
That's right.
So just get out there and connect.
Yes, and connect. Yeah. In a time that people are so disconnected, find a way to truly connect. Face to face.
Connect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Connect with people, connect with nature.
Yes. That's a really good one for the, that we didn't, I didn't mention mental health, but yeah, get outside.
Yeah.
I mean.
This is a podcast about all things non-hiking.
So yes.
There's nature.
Right.
Off the hiking trails as well.
Oh, for sure. That's, with limited time, you might have to enjoy it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, those are great tips. Okay. So as we wrap up here, how can the people, the laughers, follow you on social media or otherwise to connect with you?
So, I would love if anybody wanted to reach out. That would be wonderful. I can shield any questions or, you know, just talk.
Connect.
Big on connection. So, yes, my email is kurtisp@jmu.edu. And that's the best way to reach me.
Okay, great. That was a lot there. So
it just got forever.
It's a long email. But I love it. Anyway, but we will make sure if you are driving or working out, anything like that, we will make sure that we have her email in the show notes for you. So you can just go grab it there and connect with Steph. That would be amazing. I want to thank you for joining me today, Steph. This is sharing your story, your insights, your top five tips. This is an incredible conversation.
Yeah, this was so fun.
It was so fun. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you.
You're so awesome. And also, if you missed the other four episodes in January on health and fitness, then you need to go back and listen to those. They're chock full of information to help you elevate your fitness this year. We got some awesome content coming up, but I want to thank you today for tuning in and spending time with us. You're amazing, and I am glad that you are a part of this journey. We're just going to keep on creating more and more content to help you and as many people as we can get more out of their Shenandoah Valley experience, whether they live here or visiting here. It's a beautiful place, and it's an honor to share it. So don't forget, if you love this, to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast so you can catch more of those episodes. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in today, laughers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by the Funny Womack and Friends. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to a FWAF show or let us bring one to you. To find out more, head to thefunnywomacks.com. Be sure to share this podcast with a friend, and until next time, cheers.